Jewish women, oral history 2. Betty Schwartz and Selma Weiss are interviewing Nathan Melamed, February 27th, 1998. This is the second take. All right, so do you want to start finishing about the Manhattan Project? Or?
Sure. Well, as I said, I got hired for that project before I was had graduated, and was interviewed when the project was still in a very early stage. By the time I went to work there, when I graduated, it had expanded tremendously, and the part that I joined was at Columbia University at Havemeyer Hall. The people who had worked at Pupin under Fermi had gone to Chicago, and then subsequently a new division was started in Oak Ridge to manufacture and to separate isotopes. The Oak Ridge facility was started about the time that feasibility was shown in Chicago. And it was based on the work in which the lab in which I worked was involved. And it was to separate isotopes by a gaseous diffusion process. Needless to say, the people who worked at the project at Columbia, which by now had moved and expanded into a separate building called the Nash Building, because at one time it had housed Nash automobiles, and it was a very strong, sturdy building, easily divided into laboratories. In that building, they built labs that were just built out of 2x4s separated by chicken wire, so you can look through all the entire building. And I'll tell you a little story about that in a moment. At any rate, when the when Oak Ridge got started, when it was shown that gaseous diffusion was a viable process for separating isotopes, they built Oak Ridge. Now, Oak Ridge was not a city at that time. It was a large, barren area outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, that in rainy days became terribly muddy. In the summer was exceptionally hot and mosquito-ridden, and a very unpleasant place to build and to work. But that's where they decided to build this facility for separating isotopes. And not having any scientific personnel of their own, they turned to us at Columbia, in the Nash Building, the Manhattan Project part of it, to provide the expert personnel to build the isotope separation plant, the gaseous diffusion plant. Well, the process began by asking volunteers, and a number of people did volunteer and went to Oak Ridge. And then word started to come back about the conditions there, and the conditions were just terrible. They lived in temporary barracks. They had rather primitive facilities for eating, and they had outhouses for plumbing. All in all, the stories that came back sounded pretty dreadful. But everything was growing rapidly. Oak Ridge was expanding rapidly. The need for trained personnel kept increasing, and they had to be not only trained, but they had to have the proper clearance, and we had really the top clearance. The Manhattan Project was considered the most secret project in the country at the time. So once again, they turned to people at our facility, and they asked for volunteers. And once again, a few volunteers turned up. But then they not enough to satisfy the need. So they started to petition, so to speak, the unmarried people. And the unmarried people were told in no uncertain terms that they had to go. Well, in all this facility, there were two people who said no, and I was one of them. But my excuse was a legitimate excuse. I was about to get married. And because I was about to get married, and everyone knew this, I mean, people around the lab knew this because we had made our plans, my then wife and I had made our plans known, we could keep it secret. So they exempted me on that basis. The other person, whose name was Jerry Cohn, later changed his name, also said no. Now, he was kind of a hard-headed guy. Well, I should say hard-nosed. He said no to everything. He was hard to get along with in many ways. And, well, they couldn't force him to go, short of putting him in jail, which would not have benefited anybody. So they said okay, but they said okay, and in a very unpleasant way. And they rewarded him for his refusal by recruiting him into the army when the project was over. Now, all of us at the project had received secret clearances. And many of the draft boards were very unhappy about this, because the draft boards in those days really thought that they ran the country. And many of the draft board members really acted in a very difficult way in refusing exemptions. And so when exemptions were offered to these people and the draft board was not told what the reason was, the draft boards were very upset. And at times they made an attempt to induct people into the army despite the fact that they had gotten instructions from the colonel at our facility, who's in charge of this sort of thing, we were not to be inducted. And there was one case, for example, where a man was inducted against his objections, apparently before anyone at the project knew about it. He found himself on a train going out west. Well, the story he came back with was that somewhere in the middle of the United States, in an absolutely barren place, there was no town or anything, the train came to a stop, and a group of men boarded and started going through this train, which was filled with new recruits, and calling out his name. When they found out who he was, where he was, they took him back, brought him back to New York, and he was back working on a project, but in uniform, because there was no way they could uninduct him. So he worked on the project in uniform. And the reason, you know, there were many good reasons for doing this, because the people who worked on the project had access to what was then regarded as extremely secret information, and they didn't want to let these people loose. So it wasn't just the loss of personnel, it was their fear, their concern about somehow compromising the secrecy of the project. Now, as I started to say, the MASH building labs were built in a hurry. Things were really expanding very rapidly. They needed individual laboratories, that is to say, workspaces that people themselves could have. It could not be just one great big parking lot, so to speak. It was an internal garage. And it was four stories high. And to build these laboratories in the fastest and most expeditious way, they delineated the various rooms, the various little individual labs, by 2x4s, and then to create walls, they didn't use plaster, they used chicken wire. and the chicken wire was simply stapled to the 2x4s, and that made outline the lab space, and then against the chicken wires they would put tables, wooden tables, which were the lab benches. Well, that meant that you could look through the entire building, in effect. You could see through the whole building, more or less. And that gave rise to a lot of interesting things, but one story that I want to tell you is has to do with how I caught a spy.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was in an inner cubicle, but I could look out the window by just looking through the cubicle that was next to me, which was against the outside wall. And the windows were rather large because there was no need to keep the place particularly warm. It was basically an auto warehouse for Nash automobiles. And looking out across the street was a building, an apartment building. In fact, across the street, there was nothing but apartment buildings. And I noticed that one apartment at about the third floor, which was about at my eye level, had its shades down. And from time to time, one of the window shades would lift, just the corner of the shade would lift, and something approximating what I thought was a pair of binoculars appeared in the under the lifted shade. Well, I watched this for a while, and sure enough, periodically this would happen. So I got a little concerned, and I told my supervisor, in fact it was Eddie Adler, and he told me who to go to see. And I didn't know this, but there was a security man on, you know, the chief of security. I'd never met him before. So I called him, and he came up with me, and both of us then stood there and looked, and sure enough, from time to time, the same thing would happen. So he said, in effect, that's very interesting. And I said, in effect, well, when you find out what's going on, please let me know. Please let me know. So time went by, and weeks maybe, I don't remember exactly how long. Eventually, I went down, I happened to run into him. By this time, I knew who he was, and I said, what did you learn about that apartment across the street? He said, it was really a brothel. They had some prostitutes up there, he said, and the customers would stand in front of our building and wait until one or another of the girls were free, and they would signal him to come up by lifting the shade. Well, that didn't sound, I mean, I accepted the explanation, although it didn't ring true, because I know I looked, you know, I used to go out of that building every day at 5 o'clock. I walked home. I didn't live very far away. By this time I'd been married, and we had an apartment just a few blocks away. In fact, the building was on 96th Street, and our apartment was just roughly at a near 116th Street. So we weren't very far away, and we would walk home, and we would pass by the front of the building all the time. And I never saw anyone standing there waiting to be signaled from the room from the building across the street. But I didn't question this. When the project ended, within 6 months or so of the time the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, they took all the people, they started to disband the project, and they selected people to go down to Oak Ridge. And then others were asked, just were separated. The war was over, and there was no need to have that facility where it was, but they still needed people at Oak Ridge. It turned out that only of all the people working on the project, and there were many Jewish people working on the project, all but one Jew was separated, who was not retained. They only retained Christians, except for one Jew. And he went around, and he called himself the telephone operator Jew. And I said, what do you mean telephone operator Jew? Well, he said it means that if someone calls, and by this time, by the way, Union Carbide had taken over the project to operate the project. And Union Carbide was a chemical company. All the big chemical companies in those days were terribly anti-Semitic. So when I said, what do you mean by telephone operator Jew? He said, well, if someone calls up and says, do you have any Jews working for you? The telephone operator says you could answer yes. But that was in fact the case with all the chemical companies. And I know this from my own experience because I was turned down later when I applied for a job and I was told, we don't hire your kind. So it was, the chemical industry was quite anti-Semitic. But when the project ended...
Let me just interrupt you for 1 minute. Something came to mind. What did the people think that was going on there? When somebody asked you
Did they know? Did they know? Or you mean outside the
project? Yeah, the outsiders. What did you call this thing you were working on?
No, we just didn't. We said, we can't tell you, that's all. Okay. Let me get to that in a minute. Okay. But I just want to finish the story. So the project was over, and the war was over, and about a year or two later, a movie came out. And I remember the MASH building was on 96th Street and Broadway. The movie's name was The House on 92nd Street. And guess what? It was the story of a group of spies who rented an apartment across the street from the NASH building. Now, they didn't name it the NASH building, but the NASH building actually appeared in the film as the actual building. And they tried to see what was inside, tried to find out what was going on. So when my wife and I went to see that movie, we screamed, there it is, that's our building, that's where we work.
So you were never actually told.
I was never told, and of course I wouldn't be told.
Yeah.
In hindsight, it's obvious he wasn't going to tell me the truth, because that would set off a whole bunch of alarms, and he wasn't about to do that. But in fact, there were spies. At least if I'm to believe the movie, and the movie was supposed to have been a factual movie. And really, it did take place on location. There was the building, and there was our building.
Yeah.
The house. And it had some well-known actors in it. I don't remember who they are now at this point, but it had a woman in there who, she was the traditional spy, evil woman. What's that? No, he wasn't in that. I remember the woman well, but I can't think of her name at the moment. Now, one question that was always asked is how much did people know what's going on? Well, the people who worked on the project were not told what they were working on. They were each individually told that it was a top secret project, that we had to have absolute secrecy, but we were not told what was going on. However, a number of people inferred what was going on, and because they tried to compartmentalize the information, but we knew that we were concerned with separating uranium isotopes. In those days, very few people knew about the experiments that had been done in Germany and in Italy by Fermi about uranium and the possibility of making a nuclear explosion. So a lot of people actually could not have guessed even then what the purpose of the project was, but enough people could guess that there were some people who clearly knew about it. But one incident, we had some really oddball people on the project, and one of them went around, there was a book that had been published before the war that was called Uranium and Atomic Power. Now that book was published by a fellow named Jack DeMent, who made a career of publishing pseudoscience books based on extrapolations from a little bit of fact and a lot of imagination. And he was just a professional writer, in effect, on science. And he had written this book that came out about 2 years or so before the project really started, based on the experiments that he'd learned about in Germany and Italy. And one fellow, on the project, conspicuously went around with this book under his arm. So that he was telling the world that he knew what was going on. That was his way of telling, well, he was dealt with. And they told him in no uncertain terms that it was not the proper thing to do. So there were people who knew. When we were debriefed at the end of the project, all of us were questioned as to whether we knew what the project was about and how much we knew. And nearly everyone that I know of lied. They said we didn't. But in fact, most people had suspicions and more or less had an idea what was going on. There was a major incident involving a man named Fulton Lewis Jr., who was a right-wing radio announcer, who at some point during the war said publicly on the radio that the United States was involved in a secret project to develop the uranium bomb. And that was considered a treasonable act.
Who said that?
His name was Fulton Lewis Jr., and he was a popular right-wing radio commentator. And as far as outside people were concerned, well, when they asked me, I just told them I didn't know, or it was secret or something, and I couldn't tell them. And nobody really ever pressed me, so that was never a problem.
You started this job after you graduated college, but when did you do your postgraduate work? How did that happen?
When I stopped working for the Manhattan Project, when the project was disbanded in New York, I needed a job. And I had learned some electroplating on the job. It was part of one of the techniques that we used in our work, and so I had learned something about it. There weren't many jobs available in those days because the U.S. had not yet returned to a peacetime economy. And everything, industry was sort of in a turmoil, and it was a lot of reorganization and rethinking. And so there was a mild recession. In addition, a lot of soldiers were returning from Europe and Japan, and they too were looking in need of jobs. Many of them had children who had come along during the time they were away. And there was a surplus of work of employees and a shortage of jobs. I spotted a job. That's when I was calling up chemical companies looking for a job, and that's when people would tell me we're going to hire you. And that's when I learned that the chemical career was not a career for me. In addition,
was that post the war?
That was immediately after the war. In addition, of course, I never really liked chemistry anyway. I never did any chemistry. I always liked physics. But I did spot an ad for an electrochemist. And they wanted someone to do electrochemical work at Kroll Collier. Now, Kroll Collier was the second largest publishing company in the United States. They printed 1 million magazines a day, which is sort of mind-boggling in those days. They printed Cosmopolitan and Red Book, a lot of well-known, and Collier's Magazine, which was a big magazine in those days. But they were only second to Condé Nast. Condé Nast published 2 million magazines a day because Condé Nast published the Sunday supplements that went into most of the newspapers. In any event, they needed a person, and I went and interviewed for the job. And I remember the name of the guy who interviewed me, who headed the laboratory. His name was Axel Lundby. Kroll Collier had set up a small laboratory for the purpose of improving the speed and the quality of printing presses. Since they printed so many magazines each day, they needed, it was really important for them to have faster presses. And so they had this laboratory in CBS Studio Studio 5, I think it was, in 52nd or 53rd Street. It's still a well-known place, CBS Studio. But they had rented space there, and they needed someone to do electrochemical work in connection with a project that someone had convinced them, one bee had become convinced of its validity. And the guy who had worked on the project was about to leave, so they hired me. And I worked there for a year. But almost as soon as I started to work for Crowell Collier, I started to take graduate courses, and I went to Brooklyn Poly and took courses at night. At the end of the year, I'd taken a couple of courses at night. I decided that really to go would be to go full-time. That was the right way to go. And I still believe the right way to go to school is to go full-time, if it's at all possible. Clearly, not everyone can do that. So I approached the dean and found out that I was eligible for a scholarship, and they gave me a wonderful fellowship paid $3,200 a year, which was more than enough to live on for two people in those days. It really was a great scholarship, or fellowship, really. So then I went full-time. So I went full-time and studied under a man named Roland Kirk, who was my thesis advisor. He was very well-known in solid-state chemistry, and did work on luminescence, which got me into physics, which is what I wanted anyway. And worked there, and it took me about 2.5 years to get my thesis done, which was kind of a little bit of a record, not a big record, but it's kind of a small record. A lot of people take 3, 4, 5 years. But I was lucky, and I came to a very good conclusion of the work that was considered in those days to be fairly important. And I was able to finish in record time, so that was good. Once I got my PhD, I had to get another job. So I looked around, and Westinghouse needed, the first place I went to was Cleveland. They needed someone who knew solid-state physics. Well, this work got me into solid-state physics in a small way, but I really was not a physicist. I had taken as many physics courses as I could, but I knew some solid-state physics, so they hired me at a company in Cleveland called New Horizons. New Horizons was owned by two people, essentially completely controlled by two people, one of whom was in Princeton. He was the money man. His name was Goodrich, and another person was in Cleveland who ran the lab, and the lab was in Cleveland. They hired me, and I went to work, lived in Cleveland for about a year. It was not really a good mix. It was an interesting place to work, but they didn't have the underpinnings for what I needed and that they needed for this particular activity that they were trying to get into. They were trying to get into solid-state physics and into semiconductors, but they didn't really have the right people to work in semiconductors. But one of the little interesting side effects of that was that they got the idea to develop a method for electrolytically refining titanium. Now, titanium is an extremely important metal. It is stronger and it is much stronger than most metals, stronger than steel, at least as strong as steel, and it's lighter than aluminum. It also happens to be the second most common metal on the earth. The most common is silicon, and the second most common is titanium. But it is extraordinarily difficult to refine into a metal. And they thought they had developed a method for doing this, an electrolytic method for refining titanium. I didn't work on that, but I knew the people working on it. They set up this separate little company called Horizon Titanium, which we used to call Horse Tit. Well, Horizon Titanium, the people working on the project were given stock in Horizon Titanium. This happened like a week or two, within a month after I left the company and went to work for Leslie Hansen, they decided to issue stock in this company. Well, the stock was given to the employees based on how long they had worked, the number of days multiplied by some factor, and so people ended up with tens of thousands of shares of stock in this company at a penny a share. And then the technical people used to, would buy the shares from the handyman and the janitors and so on, who had no use for them. And so some of my friends there, this was within a month after I left, ended up with something like 100,000 shares of stock at a penny a share. Well, news got out, and all of a sudden, Horizon Titanium became a big thing. And the shares went up from 1 cent to $2.50 a share. And most of my friends unloaded their shares and became fairly well-to-do. At that time, since I lived in Pittsburgh by then, I used to go up to Cleveland once in a while to visit, and I would talk to these people. And there they were, you know, fulfilling their life's dreams. Rich people, and I missed it by 1 month.
Everybody has a sad story like that.
Well, I'm sure.
Not that sad, though. That's, okay. You know what? Let's...